Well, praise the Lord, everyone. It's Dr. Michael Morris again of For God's Glory Ministries coming to you with Bible study on CD. This is Bible study session number 122 in our series, and we're going to be covering the book of the Revelation, chapter 13. Of course, before that, we will have our quiz, which will cover the book of the Revelation, chapter 12, Bible study session number 121. We have seven questions on this quiz. The first question, who does the woman clothed with the sun represent? She represents the Jewish people. Question number two, who does the red dragon represent? He represents Satan and the spirit of Antichrist. We'll get more into the specifics during this Bible study session. Question number three. What proportion or fraction of the angels followed Satan in his rebellion against God? The answer is one third. Question number four. This is a true-false question. King Herod commanded that all Hebrew children under the age of four should be killed in an attempt to kill Jesus. Is that true or false? The answer is false. It was under the age of two. Question number five. Who is the angel that defeats Satan and kicks him out of heaven? The answer is the Archangel Michael. Question number six. How will the martyred saints overcome Satan? The answer is the same way we will overcome Satan, and that is by the blood of the Lamb. Question number seven. Satan hates whatever God blank. Fill in the blank. The answer is loves. Satan hates whatever God loves. Well, I hope you did great on the quiz, and I look forward to sharing with you the study of the book of the Revelation, chapter 13. And so with that, let's get started with our study. Now in chapter 12, we met several characters and their parts that they played in this overall story. But there's still some characters that we have yet to meet. And these are key players in this end time events. And also, I haven't forgotten that I did tell you that I would get deeper into the characteristics of the beast, the red dragon, in chapter 12 at a later time, and it's come to the point to where it is the appropriate time to do so. Now, as I prepare to do that, let me just point out a couple things that are some general points that will help you as we deal with these beasts. First of all, the word that's translated beasts in the book of the Revelation actually come from a Greek word that simply means animal, but it carries with it actually a connotation of a bad animal or a terrible animal. And so, of course, then as it's translated beast, it really sounds quite sinister. Now, when we look at these beasts in the book of the Revelation, first of all, we should know that they always represent agents of Satan. Regardless of their specific role that they play, Satan is behind them all, so know that up front. Now, secondly, these beasts have heads and horns and also crowns. And when this occurs, we talked about this before, they represent agents of the leadership or the dominating force at the time. Now, the heads always represent kingdoms or empires. And then the horns can represent various lower level controlling agents or forces or leaders. All of this, of course, is under the guise of earthly authority. Now, I'm going to cover the beast of chapter 12 for you, but I'm going to do so but at the same time that I cover the beast that's introduced in chapter 13, verse 1. And let's go ahead and read that verse real quick. It reads, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy." It can be fairly confusing, and my emphasis here is to help you to understand the beasts in the book of the Revelation. So I don't want anyone to say that there's a contradiction there. My advice is that you not try to compare the two for the sake of this discussion. Now, I'm going to touch on one subject, and then I'm going to compare these two beasts. First of all, the fact that this beast comes out of a sea usually is believed to represent that this beast comes out of people, many peoples, tongues, nations. So the sea represents many peoples. And so first of all, we see right away that this beast coming out of water represents a person or personage. And so that's one of the key distinguishing factors comparing this beast to the beast in chapter 12. And so let's go to that particular beast. And that beast was introduced in verse 3. And verse 3 reads, "And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having seven heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his heads." What I want to point out about this beast is, first of all, it was introduced really for us to understand the ultimate source of all of the rest of the imagery and the beast that are represented in the rest of the book of the Revelation. So that's the first thing. Second of all, as we look at verse 4, it clearly is making clear for us that this is Satan himself, again, as the force behind it all. And the seven heads do indeed represent the seven kingdoms or empires over the course of time that Satan will act through by impacting, if not indwelling, men of power. And the 10 horns represent lower level powers, usually regional powers, as opposed to the overall dominating empire. Of course, at the time, it was the Roman Empire, and of course, Caesar was the dominating leader and force, creating the policies and enforcing them. And then see that the seven crowns are upon the heads. The key thing here is that the emphasis is on the empires or the kingdoms. That's really the point here. This verse is bringing out the big picture. We're going to get more specific, but it's bringing out the big picture. You've got Satan, the originator of sin. Okay. So we've got this major player. These couple verses point out where he came from, how he ended up down here on earth in his career here on earth. Also shows us where his minions or demons originate from. So it's that big picture. And then we talk about the various empires that he has operated through. And that's why the crowns are on the heads and not on the horns. The emphasis here is not on the regional, temporal leadership or powers. So this represents the kingdoms that he's acted through or the empires that he's acted through over time. And the emphasis is not on the leaders at the specific moment in time. even though the leaders are there, they definitely are not the emphasis in that verse. Now let's contrast that with the beast in verse 1 of chapter 13. Now we still have seven heads and we still have 10 horns. There's a point that's already been made about him coming out of the sea. Secondly, the crowns are on the 10 horns as opposed to the heads. And so the point here is that at the time of the emergence of the Antichrist initially, there will be no obvious dominating worldwide kingdom or empire. That's a very important point to note. And so the crowns are on the horns. The crowns are on the regional or geographical powers, representative of separate sovereign authorities. Quite important. So keep that in mind. The other thing that's important to point out is even though we know clearly Satan's standing, in terms of God, we see here that this force, this Antichrist force on earth, has upon his heads the name, or actually that should say names of blasphemy. It was translated as singular, but it should be plural, and it really points to several statements that represent the Antichrist positioning in regards to God on earth and what he takes himself to be. And you'll see what we mean more by that later. And so hopefully this helps you understand the distinctions between the two beasts. And also the other thing that you should note is that you really have to fast forward at least 2,000 years from the beast in chapter 12, verse 3, to the beast here in chapter 13, verse 1. And so for us, the first beast is clearly in the past. However, for us, this beast in verse 1, this Antichrist, is in our future. Now, I'm not going to delay your understanding of this beast at all. We're very fortunate in that John received further explanation himself in chapter 17. So if you were struggling with the beast, don't feel bad. John couldn't figure it out on his own either. And so in chapter 17, we get a little help, as did John. And this is part of an explanation of the same beast when it was sat upon by the woman in purple and scarlet, and more about her later. But for now, John is told of the beast in verse 9. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And later we're told that the woman is a city. And Rome has for centuries been known as a city on seven hills or seven mountains. And so, in fact, the Greek word oros is translated as mountains in the King James, but the Amplified prefers hills. So the heads of the beast represent Rome. And this is a part of the reason why Bible scholars say that the Antichrist will rule from a revived version of the Roman Empire. Now, most say actually that the seat of power will be physically Rome itself, geographically speaking, and largely due to this verse here in chapter 17. But as we read further, we see more purpose to these heads. Yes, they are representative of mountains, which points to Rome, but there's an additional purpose. And so in verse 10, it says, "And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come." Well, the Amplified says, "not yet appeared. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space." Now, note that these are not really kings, but rather kingdoms or empires. the historical world empires occurred in ancient times. And in their sequential order, they were the Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Greek, and Roman empires. And at the time of John's writing of the book of the Revelation, the Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian, and Medo-Persian, and Greek empires had fallen. And the one that was in power at the time was Rome. And so in verse 10, where it says, and one is, that's exactly why it said that. So the next world empire after Rome will be that of the Antichrist, or at least the Antichrist precursor. And I could say more on that, but it's better that we hold off. Just keep that in the back of your mind. So that's good enough for now. If we went on here on that subject without more background and context, it would cause confusion. So suffice it to say that the beast of chapter 13, verse 1 represents the system or kingdom of political power and religion in the end times via the spirit of Antichrist. Now let's learn some more about this beast in verse 2. It reads, and the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth was the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, and his seat, and great authority. Now, none of this symbolism here that we read in verse 2 would be foreign to the first century readers at all. Certainly not the first century Jews. And let me show you why that is. Let's look, if you have your Bibles with you, let's take a look at Daniel, the book of Daniel, chapter 7. And I'm actually just going to read verses 1 through 7 for you, or along with you, hopefully. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matter, of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove against the sea, the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. In verse 6, after this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. Verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I bet those 10 horns are familiar to you. Sounds very familiar, huh? Well, let's take a quick look. What we see is at the time of Daniel's dreams here, the Egyptian and the Assyrian empires had already passed, and they were in the midst of the Babylonian empire domination. And what Daniel is showing here to the king Nebuchadnezzar through his dreams is one, the great Babylonian Empire, embodied in King Nebuchadnezzar himself, the empire being given the heart of a man, but also showing sequentially the conquering of the empire of Babylon and the subsequent domination and conquering of the other empires that came after it, ending with the empire which was diverse from the others or different from the others, even in its description, and that being Rome. And that's where at least this vision leaves off. And so Rome, which we've gotten to know pretty well, took over for the Greco-Macedonian Empire. And that empire was known for its advancements in arts and sciences, its philosophies and architecture and literature and language. And then going further back, the bear that represented the Medo-Persian Empire with its pagan splendor and wealth. And then you go back to the time of the writings, and that is the Babylonian Empire, known for its autocracy, embodied in King Nebuchadnezzar, having his image erected, the golden image erected, and expecting everyone to bow down to it. Now, my reason for taking you through those verses in Daniel were simply to convince you that in reading or listening to the writings of John here in Revelation chapter 13, verse 2, this would not at all have been strange or unfamiliar to those who knew of the Old Testament. And so that's an important perspective to understand in terms of our interpretation of these writings. They wouldn't have been weird or mystical to the readers. So if we make them weird or mystical, we're going to miss the point. And so ultimately, the point of this is that the world dominating power at that point will have characteristics of past powers. Now, it may also be pointing to the universality of this regime, of this dominating regime, with including all peoples and nations and tongues that will be under the power, and its authority. And it's no small thing at all that the dragon, Satan himself, is the force behind the Antichrist's actions and his authority. Note also that up to this point, this beast is not singled out as a person. We're working our way up to that, but it hasn't been singled out as a person. It has all of the features still of an empire or a system. And in fact, the Greek word used here to refer to the beast is autos, which is in a third person pronoun that can be translated as it rather than he or she. I make that point really so that you don't get too honed in on an individual person or looking toward a person. It's far more important, especially at this point, to understand that it is a political and ultimately also a religious system that will dominate the world. Less importantly at this point, an individual person, although I know that that tends to be more popular and sexy to think about and to want to learn about. But what I am grateful for from this particular verse, verse 2, is that we do know some things now about the Antichrist system of domination. It will have the characteristics that will be disarming for people in terms of advancements in arts and sciences and architecture and literature, etc. But that it will also be full of pagan splendors, all of the joys and enjoyment of the flesh. People will have access to just about anything that their flesh desires, and wealth will be prominent through this system. So again, something that people will be disarmed by. And then also, there will be a singular leadership. which events will occur coming up to that point that will lead people to believe that this is the right thing to do. That leader will usher in events and circumstances that will be favorable to people, and therefore they're likely to accept his leadership. Now, we all know, or most of us do, that that those good times will not last. And we'll talk about that on another occasion. But I would imagine that more than a few of you are saying, but boy, that sounds a lot like Roman times. And some others of you are probably saying, whoa, wait a minute. That sounds a lot like what we're going through right now. That's, I don't know. Are we in those times right now? Is the Antichrist somewhere, you know, dominating right now? Well, first of all, we would know if the Antichrist was dominating. But we also know that the beginning portion of the Antichrist's work will be much more subtle, and then ultimately much more overt. And so in these next upcoming verses, I think we're going to get some information that will make it much clearer to us who and what we'll be dealing with, and it'll answer a lot of those questions and alleviate any confusion in terms of where we are in the timing of these events. So let's read verses 3 and 4. And I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon that gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? Now remember, as we read this, that the heads of the beast represent one, the seven hills, and two, the seven empires or kingdoms. Now, this series of events we know are not related to hills, physical hills for sure, or just a physical place. So it's the kingdom or empires really that this is focused on, or the people that this is focused on. But I believe that at this point, if we go too far down that track, we will be again focused on identifying the actual individual and really get thrown off the real track of what we can most benefit from these scriptures. And so I think now is a great time to give you a very important warning about trying to interpret the imagery in this book, especially in the remaining chapters. The beast's heads and horns and crowns, even though we certainly can now, up to this point, make some sense of them, all of this imagery and the scriptures around them have been dissected in more ways than I can tell you, by some very smart people. But I'll point out to you that these dissections have led to variations of interpretation of the book of the Revelation, and more variations than I can count. Now, much of Daniel's imagery is and was at that time already history. And so at the time of John's writings, the interpretations were much clearer of Daniel's imagery. But what I find in studying and researching the book of the Revelation is, unfortunately, I find camps. I find camps of folks that have decided certain things. They've decided who the Antichrist has to be. They've decided it's the Catholic Church. They've decided Babylon is the United States because it's prominent in our time, or the time of the writings of the person. They've decided various things. And it's pretty clear that with this slicing and dicing, those who write most of the commentary on the book of the Revelation, somewhere along the way, seem to find the need to stick to their guns and to justify their own biases. And I'm not saying this in a sinister way, nor am I attributing any sinister or bad intentions on the part of those who work so diligently to try to bring the truth to others. But just as with all of the rest of the scripture, this intense slicing and dicing and mincing every single word only leads to schisms that have yet to help us, that have yet to assist us. In many camps, just with different views, all determining that they must be right. And so what I've said many times to you, that, you know, God's truth is usually hiding in plain sight. And so we need only get out of our own way, out of our own heads long enough and take a step back to see the forest and not to be distracted by the trees. So I'm not condemning or even criticizing any of those who have worked so diligently in attempts to crack the code of this book. But what I am saying is that I'm determined to bring the best of what God would want for us through the study of this book. And so, as many of you know, I took a break between recording Revelation chapter 11 and 12. And that was because I wasn't satisfied that I had the adequate godly perspective on these scriptures that I've always wanted to offer you up to this point. And so the book of the Revelation is no exception. And so I just was not satisfied merely sharing with you all the various opinions that people put forth as fact on this amazing book. And also the opinions are so numerous and the interpretations are so varied, I could never have enough time to do that for you. And I certainly would find it extremely unsatisfying even to try. So ironically, those of you who want to use this instruction to go out and to win a debate, like the rest of my teachings, this may not be for you. But as usual, if you want a better ability to discern the mind and the heart of God and to understand and get to know his plans for us individually and as a people, as human beings, then stay tuned. And so with that, we get back to verse 3 and 4 of chapter 13. And not surprisingly, the majority of the time, study and focus, most of it is put on verse 3. But verse 4 is even more important to God. And so while verse 3 certainly begins to point to the who, we know that either the empire at the time or a component of the empire will be threatened or brought down and will come back, or an individual will sustain a wound and will be able to come back from that wound and have that wound healed. Actually, it doesn't really matter which one it turns out to be. The most critical piece really pertains to verse 4. And frankly, understanding verse 4, I think, is key to having confidence about verse 3. Now, verse 4 again reads, "And they worshiped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" Now, as I said, this verse is even more important to God. The individual human or institution that happens to be the pawn of Satan's plans are nice to know, but not so critical. What is important is the result of those events and the impact on God's creation that he loves so much. Because as a result of this prowess that this Antichrist personage or system in dealing with this threat, they will actually worship the dragon. Now, this doesn't say up front that they're going to worship the beast. The first thing they said is they will worship the dragon. That's even worse. That's worshiping Satan himself. That's devastating. That's horrible. And by the way, I felt so strongly about this that I wanted to make sure that I understood what was intended when the translators translated this as worship. And literally the Greek word that is used there is proskuneo. And it actually means to fawn, to crouch down, or to prostrate oneself in homage, in reverence and adoration. And so it's not just to admire this person. This is actually to prostrate oneself in adoration and actual worship. And so that's really sad and unfortunate that this will occur. And then it goes on to say that they worship the beast, saying, who's like the beast? So they're worshiping both the beast as a result of or because of his prowess, and then also worshiping the dragon that gave power to the beast. And as we've discussed before, there is no mistaking who the dragon is. We can argue about, you know, the various horns and all that sort of stuff on the beast. And some would even argue about who the beast is. Again, that's when they're focused on the actual individual that they get off track on. But we know who the dragon is. And so God is most concerned about the fact that his creation is going to be deceived and duped into and pushed to the point of worshiping Satan himself. But this is exactly what Satan wants. He wants to take away the adoration that's supposed to go to God himself, and he wants to get that adoration. And as important as anything, when that occurs, he knows what that means for those who are worshiping him. He knows that those that might have otherwise served God will actually go into perdition with him. Again, the unfortunate thing is that people will be either so impressed, seduced, or intimidated by the beast's abilities that they will do the unthinkable. One last point before we go to verse 5 is this issue of the worshiping the beast that gave dragon that gave power to the beast. First, we've already pointed out that this really is Satan. Clearly, it is Satan. But the other point is this term power. You know, what Greek word is it translated from? As we've discussed before, there are two key words translated power in the New Testament. And one is dunamis, which means actual physical power to do something. The other one is exousia. And that is the one that means authority. And that's the one that's used here. And so Satan, the dragon, gives authority to the beast to do these things, gives authority to the beast to work these great works and to do all the things that he will do. And so this isn't just power. This is authority. So people will bow down to the beast, and they will worship the dragon that gives the authority to the beast. So the beast will do whatever he does in the name of the dragon. And somehow people will fall for that. And Satan will at that point at least be successful in large measure in creating his antichrist system, his father, son, and we will talk a little bit about the Holy Spirit, part of his false, unholy Trinity. He will get mankind to, again, as I said before, give to him what belongs solely to God. All right. Now, while our spiritual antennas are fine-tuned and our perspective is healthy, let's go ahead and look at verses 5-8. And there was given unto him, that is the beast, a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. So these verses definitely leave no doubt as to whether this character deserves the title of Antichrist. I think that's pretty plain to see. And when John says that he will speak great things, he means boastful things. So he'll be boasting. He'll blaspheme by declaring himself to be in the place of God and to debase God verbally and everything genuinely connected to God he'll put down. Antichrist will be drunk with this power, and he'll be able to wield this power to persecute God's people during what will mercifully be a relatively short period of time, 3.5 years. Now, remember, according to Daniel's week of years, which is 7 years, the Antichrist will be in power for about half of that time before he actually reveals his true colors. And we'll speak more on that sometime later. But for now, let's just reflect honestly for a second based on what we've seen in these last few verses. And I know that most of you believe that all of God's true believers will be gone by this time as a result of a pre-tribulation rapture. But I would just ask you to think about if that were not the case. Which one are you? Which number are you counted in? Are you one of the folks who would resist the temptation to follow the beast system, to worship the beast, to go along with the program? Or would you be one that would be willing to suffer in the name of Christ? One of those that God will avenge, one of those that God is attempting to console and to encourage through the book of the Revelation. Hopefully, if you're listening, your name is indeed written in the Lamb's book of life, the Lamb that was slain from the foundation of the earth. And so while we think about that, I know that also most of us claim that we know that Jesus is coming soon, and most of us claim that we want him to come soon. Let the truth be known, most of us don't really want that. Even if we think it's going to happen, we really don't want that. We are way too busy consuming life here on earth. Okay, and if we believe that having faith for material things, which so many of our preachers and parishioners are preoccupied with right now, if we think that's impressive, then just know that you won't find it in the book of Revelation. If that's the kind of faith that impresses you, you won't find it here. Frankly, you certainly won't find that being the hallmark of any tribulation period saint. And so if you're not gone in a pre-tribulation rapture and these times come, that kind of faith that we tout so much nowadays will not cut it. The tribulation period saints would actually really welcome a rapture because it will be challenging. They will have to have true faith in a living God, even in the absence of a lot of the physical manifestations as the Antichrist system dominates. These are the folks who would welcome a rapture. Today's church, as I've said before, really mirroring the church of Laodicea in chapter 3 of Revelation, is not living in genuine anticipation of God delivering them from any terrible earthly circumstances. It's not living counter to man's system. It is mostly going along with and blending into man's system. And so any Christians operating in that same mode will absolutely not withstand the rigors that the Antichrist system will bring with it when it's in full force. Now, there are definitely the comments that I'm making are largely aimed at the Christian church in the developed world where there's plenty and there's relative peace. But those in the underdeveloped world, definitely are dealing with persecution. One, because of being poor, but also there are some countries that don't allow for free expression of religion. So they definitely would welcome a rapture. That's simply not the case in the majority of the developed countries. And I just thought I'd point that out as a matter of truth. But fortunately, God definitely and truly sees, he knows, and he cares about the downtrodden and the less earthly fortunate. And this book is largely written to comfort those who suffer for his name's sake. And one token of that sentiment we'll find in the next couple of verses. So let's look at verses 9 and 10. Well, John writes, "If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints." So as you can see here, these events will be real. And God is attempting to encourage those who will stand up for his name and to let them know that those that harm you will absolutely be harmed. Whatever measure they mete out to God's people, they will receive it in return, but oh, much more, much, much more as they go into perdition and eternal damnation and destruction. And so this is the faith and the patience of the saints, as the Bible says. Okay, now as we prepare for verse 11, I have a question to ask you. Now, I would imagine that whether you're a student of the Bible or not, you probably have heard of the Antichrist. Who hasn't? But have you heard of the false prophet? This next character is as important, if not more important, in this story. He is a third member of the Antichrist's false or unholy trinity. Again, Satan as the Father, the Antichrist as the Son, and the false prophet in the place of the Holy Spirit or the Holy Ghost. Satan plans to hurt God by hurting those that God cares about and hurting them more spiritually than physically. As we've seen many times over, those that he hurts physically will be redeemed spiritually, but it's those that he deceives spiritually, those that will go into perdition with him because of their spiritual wrongdoings, those are the ones that are most impacted in the long run. Now, there is so much in these upcoming verses where this false prophet is introduced that I'm only going to give you bite-sized chunks at a time. First, we'll take a look at verses 11 and 12. "And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all of the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed." So here we see a second reason why the masses will worship the Antichrist. One, because they will wonder how amazing it is that he survives the deadly wound. And secondly, because there's this religious figure, the false prophet, that will persuade them, compel them to worship the Antichrist and, of course, the dragon. This religious figure will present himself as an innocent, but what he will say and do will serve purely the purposes of Satan. He will convince the world to worship the Antichrist and his image. Now let's take a quick look here, back at verse 12. where it says that he exercised all of the power of the first beast before him. I just wanted to point out so that there's no misunderstandings. This means in his presence. So he will exercise all of the authority of the first beast in his presence. They will be working in concert. One, luring in the world's masses due to his charisma and military prowess and political abilities. And the other one will seduce us under the guise of religion, causing most of mankind to worship the beast, to worship the representative of Satan himself, to worship the man who is Satan incarnate, and to bow down to the Antichrist system. Of course, the enemy of God and Christ. So now that we know that the Antichrist and the false prophet will be working in concert, let's take a look at verse 13 and begin to learn how this comes to be. Verse 13 reads, "And he doth great wonders." That's the false prophet. "He doth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men." So the first thing that this false prophet will do is that he will mimic the feat of arguably God's greatest Old Testament prophet, Elijah. Now you may recall that in Elijah's famous showdown against all of the prophets of Baal, that he caused fire to come down from heaven. Baal did not answer the call of all the false prophets, but Yahweh did indeed answer Elijah's call and consumed the animal that was prepared on the altar. And this is something that helped prove that Elijah and his God were the real deal, and of course Baal and his prophets were not. Now, because of the specific nature of this miracle, unfortunately, many Jews will likely be taken with it, especially since in the book of Joel, the prophet, he says in the end days that he will send them Elijah. And unfortunately, I think that this is going to cause many of them to stray. And so it's really a shame that God's people are attracted to these types of spectacles when the rest of what the performer does is not consistent with God. It's just the miraculous, the amazing that attracts us nonetheless. But on the other hand, for those who do indeed follow the beast, are seduced by the beast, that worship the beast, the good thing is that in essence, those folks are worshiping their God. Their names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And so I suppose that it's only fitting. And so before we go to verse 14, I'm just going to take you over to Revelation chapter 19. And let's look at verses 19 and 20, because I just want you to see, this is the first time that maybe some of you, maybe many of you, have even heard of the false prophet. And you may wonder with this imagery, you know, where the terminology comes from. But this is not something that's part of any confusion, or for that matter, a whole lot of debate. So verses 19 and 20 read, "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gather together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army." This is talking about the battle of Armageddon. "And the beast was taken with him and his false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast, and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone." So I just wanted to point out for you that this term false prophet is not something that was just contrived. It actually is something that God, through John, confirmed later in the book. Now verse 14 in chapter 13. And again, still talking about the false prophet, This is after he's brought down the fire in the sight of men, and as a result of that fire, and deceiveth them that dwell on earth by means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on earth that they should make an image to the beast, which had the wound by a sword and did live. So this verse points to another issue that should grab the attention of the Jews. While many in the Christian world may have been desensitized to this issue because of the Catholic practices, the Jews know the gravity of the second commandment. So thus far, the Antichrist system has mankind disobeying the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other God before me." And then now the second commandment, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God." Now, for more on the work of this false prophet, we read in verse 15, "And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed." Now, this should sound very familiar to those of you who've read the book of Daniel. This is the same thing that happened in Babylon when King Nebuchadnezzar had an image built unto himself. And of course, the punishment in that case was to be thrown into a fiery furnace. You can see that in Daniel chapter 3. So no one up to this point, that is the Bible commentators and theologians, have been able to adequately explain how the false prophet will cause the statue or the image to speak. But if you're around at that time when this happens, Dorothy, you can definitely be sure you're not in Kansas anymore. That's for sure. So, Dorothy, would you bow down or would you die? What's the big deal, right? Everybody else is doing it. It's just a little simple act. Who cares? Right? Well, just remember what God said about this. Remember the first and the second commandments. And so now that you've contemplated and answered this question for yourselves, we get to that very intriguing and I'm surely highly anticipated mark of the beast. I am sure that more than a few of you are curious about this matter. Now let's read verses 16 and 17, still talking about the false prophet. "And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that hath the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name." Now, the Greek word that's translated here as mark is karagma, and it means a scratching or engraving or an etching or stamp type of a thing that's like a badge of servitude or allegiance. Now, trust me, when this happens, you won't be able to get around the responsibility for having taken the mark for the sake of, in the name of, commerce. If you take this mark, you'll know what you're doing. You'll know that you are claiming the allegiance to the beast for whom the mark represents. And in chapter 14, you'll find out just what happens to those who do. Let's just say both groups actually will suffer by fire. One group, those who don't take the mark, will suffer temporarily. Those who do will suffer by fire forever. Let's put it that way. And that brings us to probably the most well-known verse in all of the book of the Revelation, and that would be verse 18, the verse which introduces the enigmatic 666. Now, verse 16 told us, before we get to 18, verse 16 told us where the mark of the beast will be located. Verse 17 told us the practical meaning of the mark and that the beast's name is associated with that mark. And then finally, the number of his name is associated. Now, despite the way that this verse reads, this may not be an either or, either the mark, the name, or the number of the name. But what we do know is that it will be an absolute requirement for buying and selling. Now that could be, you can think of that as commerce. You can also think of it as the ability to survive. So who cares about this number? Well, normally I would tell you not to concern yourself with it. It's not part of your salvation. It's not going to make or break you anywhere along the way. But I'm not quite saying that here. John only uses the kind of language that he uses here twice in this whole book of the Revelation. And the other time we'll get to in chapter 17. So just twice, the reader is invited to know something that is knowable with the application of intellect. This is where the Greek word for wisdom, which is Sophia, is utilized. So if you know anyone, by the way, named Sophia, now you know sort of the meaning of the name. Sophia means wisdom. And in this context, it's inviting you to apply actual, particularly in terms of the number of the beast, it's inviting you to use your intellect to determine the answer. So the reader or the hearer is offered the chance to identify these key players in the story. But actually, up to this point in the book, there are key pieces of information that are still not yet revealed. So we'll be coming back to this issue later. But simply put, how could the readers of the time both know the number, the mark, etc., and what would that knowledge do for them? So how could they know? And what could that knowledge do for them? How could they know this number and the name? And then, so what? The answer to the first question is the easiest to address. So we'll do that first. At the time of this writing, it was a common practice to associate a word or a name with a number. Now, the reason for this is that they didn't have the Arabic numbering system that we now use. And instead, they used the letter of the alphabet, whether it be Greek or Hebrew, and each letter was given a numerical value. And then any word would basically have a value by adding up the numbers from its letters. So the Roman numerals, as you likely already know, are derived from letters. Now, in this case, when it comes to the number 666, whether you use the Greek letters or Hebrew, all roads with the 666 at that time led to Rome as a city and as a world dominating empire, and it led to Rome's leaders. Now, this fact may mean nothing to us, but it would have been very comforting and encouraging to those believers who were being at that time or who would be persecuted, particularly given the fact that the persecutors will suffer not a very good end as described in chapter 14. So it would have been very comforting to them, for them to use their knowledge, their intellect, to come to know the names or the city or the institutions associated with this mark that clearly is told will meet with destruction. They'll feel very vindicated. Now, there were many, many names at that time that added up to 666. So it's really not about an individual. But there is, of course, that temptation, and that has not stopped folks for millennia now from trying to pin down a name, identify an actual individual that this number is referring to. That is not where the wisdom lies. The wisdom lies in the understanding at that time in particular that all of the names that they came up with and all of the signs pointed to Rome. Again, there were many names that added up to 666, such as Caesar Nero, Caesar Caligula, also Caesar Domitian, and also the title for the emperor in general added up to 666, the title of the pope, certain popes' names themselves, even Muhammad adds up to 666. But of course, none of these names would have been known to the original readers, or the majority of these names would not have been known. Certainly the Pope, Muhammad, things like that would not have been known to the original readers and therefore would have no utility for them. Now, the point is that you just can't pin down one person, at least without much more contextual data and criteria that have to be met. So we'll learn more of these criteria for who this person could be or could possibly be as we study further. But remember, in end times, it will not be a secret. It will not be hidden. So the idea of if you could know the name in advance, you won't need the name. Again, the purpose of the name is really more utility for the folks back then. The knowledge of the name being derived from the number, again, is purely for their benefit. Now, by the way, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, easily the most active in Daniel and Revelation study of all the churches, is very satisfied that the papacy is the Antichrist and that the Catholic Church is the beast. They point to the Pope changing the Sabbath observance day from Saturday to Sunday as a sentinel event. And it's the focal point of their belief system. Now let's go ahead at this point and read verse 18. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, before we wrap up, I think this verse points to something that I would like to highlight, and that is the one aspect of interpreting this final verse that does not require additional information. The number 666 or 666 highlights the number of man. This, of course, this number being below that of the number of completion in God's number, which is 7. So no matter what claims this leader makes, he is known beforehand to be a fraud and less than what he claims. There's plenty of wisdom in that fact, whether you're in the first century or in the 21st century. And whether the mark itself is an etching, a computer chip under your skin, a tattoo, barcodes in the grocery stores or elsewhere, it really won't matter in the end. So now after all of that, you may have been living in anticipation of, you know, what's this 666 business all about? Who is it? Can we name him? Can we know the Antichrist in advance? The way that you will identify the Antichrist in the 21st century, should he come to power during our time, is by what he does, is by his actions, by his words, by people's response, by world events, by geopolitical happenings. It won't be by his name. There are many, many names that would match. You won't be able to go about it that way. And it will be so plain to see that I don't think you'll be getting letters and adding them up in order to confirm for yourself that this is indeed that leader, that world leader, that people throughout the world will deify, will worship, will follow, will adore, will revere, and will fear. I don't think it'll be subtle. So, hate to disappoint you in terms of the whole mystery of the number, and we're not done yet with all of these matters, but in terms of this number, this point in time, I hope that this perspective, and this understanding of what God is trying to say, both in the first century to now, I hope that this puts you in a better position to digest the rest of what we're going to study in the book of Revelation and gives you a proper perspective to do so.